And my wife always tells me to never begin speaking with an apology. In most areas, I usually try to adhere to her good judgment, which is almost always correct. I will take an exception this morning to make two apologies before we begin. The first is that normally when I've given shiurim here, other places, so you know, I've always given out Mar Mekomo, source sheets. This week was a particularly busy week, and sort of the feeling also that this topic of four rabbinic responses to Haskalah and Reform might not necessarily be conducive towards a standard shiur, so I did not do that. And the second apology is that for anybody who has any sense of Jewish history of the last few hundred years, the very idea that you can discuss this topic, right, rabbinic responses to Reform and Haskalah, and to even begin to do the topic justice, and clearly that's impossible, right? You know, each one of these things, each one of the personalities, even to begin to discuss Haskalah Reform itself is a complete college course, a complete graduate school course. So to try to get a lot covered, obviously, is just skimming the surface. I know there are many people here that I'm sure have researched the topic and aware of the topic, but this is almost much more of a general survey and some general reflections. Before discussing the rabbinic responses, the four rabbinic responses, let's mention a word about Haskalah and Reform. Now, as many people know, there were many circumstances, there were many events prior to the emancipation of the Jewish people in Europe in 1786. If a person looks at the events of the 17th century and the 18th century, it's really a hotbed of conflict, of transition, often of tremendous loss and confusion between the Cossacks and the tremendous loss of life in the 17th century. Shabtai Tzvi, that as we know had an impact, and the impact of Shabtai Tzvi reverberated for hundreds of years afterwards, and the tremendous fallout and depression and searching for meaning that Shabtai Tzvi, of course, brought about the Jewish people. The rise of Hasidus in the 18th century, which of course for many was positive, but for many they saw it as a gross anti-intellectualism of the Jewish people, which also created a certain level of conflict. The financial strait that people found themselves in, the feeling that there was a unbridgeable divide between those who could learn, those who were serious about learning, and those who were amaratzim. All this led to tremendous upheaval in the 17th century, in the 18th century, and all of which caused essentially each successive event afterwards. Meaning Shabtai Tzvi, often sort of what one could say, let the Hasidus, the Cossacks, let the Hasidus. Hasidus often then gave rise to a feeling of perhaps priding oneself in a certain intellectualism. Right? Each one of these events impacted the future. Each impacted all future events. And when emancipation came, the Jewish community found themselves with an unbelievable conflict. Freedom to now express religion openly, freedom to now form their own Jewish community, freedom of expression. At the same time, an overpowering movement in society of enlightenment, of capitalism, of intellectualism, of an openness to ideas, and the confluence of all the past events for the past 150 years in the Jewish community, with this newfound freedom of religion, together with the strong changes, strong seeds of change in the community, a focus on intellectualism, a focus on rigorous thinking, clearly left the Jewish community exceedingly vulnerable and exceedingly open to what was often a change that in certain ways was good, certain ways was positive, and in certain ways was dramatically not positive for the Jewish people. A note about the Haskalah and the Reform. The Haskalah really began, the Jewish Haskalah, in the late 18th century. And, of course, its original tentacles was felt first in Western Europe, and then more so afterwards in the mid-19th century in Eastern Europe. Everything that ever happens in Eastern Europe happened after Western Europe. It was it was a different type of community. Western Europe, Hungary, and Germany were more open, more cultured, more integrated, as opposed to Eastern Europe, where that was not the case. So all changes happened afterwards. And even within Haskalah itself, says a word of introduction, there are really different types of strands of maskilim. You would have those maskilim that we would probably be called, I don't want to denigrate any of us or insult any of us, by many standards we'd be called maskilim, right? People who are Orthodox people, but speak English as opposed to Yiddish, value education, value mathematics, right? I mean, maskilim who were people that were perhaps more open towards education and culture, but certainly not radically trying to change Orthodox Judaism. And then as time went on, there was a much more radical branch of maskilim, very anti-Orthodox, very biting, very negative, trying to tear down all previous institutions. And within Reform Judaism also, the radical reform was not the original reform. You know, that's what made dealing with Haskalah and reform so complicated, because the original presentation of Haskalah and reform perhaps might have been positive. The original reformers did not try to do away with Shabbos. They didn't try to do away with Bris Milah. They said, you know, let's update the shul. Let's maybe translate certain things into German so more people can be involved. Let's bring a choir into a shul. And the challenge of the leadership was to how to evaluate those early stages. How much do we try to integrate some of the changes into Orthodoxy? How much do we try to reject those changes? Do we view the motivations of the early maskilim, the early reformers, askance with skepticism? Or do we view they're trying to do something L'shem Shemayim? These were all the challenges that perhaps now, 200 years later, we could look at with clarity. But certainly back in the beginning of the 19th century, the mid-19th century, these were issues that were very much in flux. I want to really begin discussing the four personalities that I wanted to spend most of the morning on. Right? Each one of these personalities have had many books, including Art Scroll, including things of more academic nature, written about them. Sometimes it's hard to separate reality from lore. You look back on people and you try to create a certain image. And the first personality out of the four, just time-wise, was of course the Chassam Sofer. Right? Chassam Sofer was a person whose impact is very, very much felt to this day. And the Chassam Sofer was born in 1762, and even though it's in vogue to say that this person was a genius and that person was a genius, this person finished Shas by the age of a year and a half, this person was writing Svarim when he was six, right? It seems that even sort of filtering through the haze of modern historiography, you know, one can still say with confidence that the Chassam Sofer was a rare personality. By the age of five, the Chassam Sofer had finished Maseches Beitzam, or Beyam, and he made a public siyum for the entire community. And at that siyum, he spoke for an hour about various chidushim in Maseches Beitzam, the sugyas of mitoch, and other such things at age 5 years old. And it's very clear at a certain age that this was going to be the prize jewel of the Jewish community. Right? The Chassam Sofer was born in Frankfurt, back during Frankfurt's real prime years, during Frankfurt at its peak. And there was always like a claiming, who was gonna claim this rare Gaon with this unbelievably strong and confident personality? There was a dispute between the Chassam Sofer's father, who was also a Gadol, and Rav Nosson Adler. The details itself might be a little bit hazy, but what's that? Rav Nosson Adler was the teacher. Rav Nosson Adler was sort of the Gadol. It was about 25 years older than the Chassam Sofer. The way that the story goes, again, no one was seen there with a tape recorder or anything else, was that the Chassam Sofer, even as a young teenager, had criticized his grandfather, the Maharshach. And the Chassam Sofer's father got up and said, "My son criticizing publicly the Chiddushim of your grandfather," and he smacked him across the face. And Rav Nosson Adler, who was a very well-known figure, a very charismatic figure, told the father, said, "You know what? The personalities are too strong. The there's too much friction, perhaps. Let me take over the tutelage of your son, Rav Moshe Sofer, of Moshe Schreiber, and Kach Hava. Right? Rav Moshe Sofer, Chassam Sofer, became the student of Nosson Adler. He studied by him for many years. And even for years, in his early 20s, people tried to attract him to be the Rav of their community, to be a Rosh Yeshiva. And the Chassam Sofer always rejected those efforts. And at a certain point, he, in his 30s and 40s, he became the Rav. First in smaller communities, then in Mattersdorf, which was in Austria, then in Bratislava, which is part of the Austrian-Hungary area, and then, of course, he founded the yeshiva in Pressburg, where he stayed for most of the rest of his life, or for the rest of his life. What was so unique about the Chassam Sofer, and why are almost his tentacles, why is his impact felt clearly to today? And I'm sure everyone here knows that Chassam Sofer was famous, most famous, that Chadash Aser Min HaTorah, that nothing new is allowed in Judaism, that one can never give an inch to reform, to modernity. In those years, Chassam Sofer was Nifter in the 1830s, so the reform was essentially in its intimacy, in its very beginning stages, 1810, 1820. And the efforts of the reform, again, on face value, didn't seem radical. They said there should be a temple, which is what they called it, which of course is a problem already, and that should be open only on Shabbos. This should be the meeting place only on the Sabbath, only on Shabbos. They said we should translate the Siddur, parts of it, into German. There was a change of the Siddur. And they wanted to bring an organ into the shul as well. And they claimed the most beneficial, the most positive motivations for these actions will bring more Jews in. It can make us look positive in the eyes of the Germans around them. And the Chassam Sofer saw right through it. The Chassam Sofer said, you begin to make a small change, all this is an attack on Yahadus. Rav Moshe Mendelssohn had wanted to translate the Chumash into German and also make a commentary. And the Chassam Sofer felt that there can be no acquiescence to a change of language. He said, once you go ahead and once you begin to assess Judaism through a different language, through a different culture, through a different perspective, then Judaism, Halacha, the Torah, they become subject to that discipline, to the ideology, to the principles of that discipline. Judaism has to stay completely separate from anything secular. Once a Jew knows secular studies, then they apply the knowledge of those secular studies to the Torah. Once a Jew starts speaking other languages, they apply the background, the ideology of those languages to the Torah. That the only way the Torah stays true is by keeping it completely removed, completely separate from other languages, from other forms of knowledge. The Chassam Sofer felt that one had to stay completely separate. The Chassam Sofer had many tshuvos that showed this incredibly strong, this dominant, this separate nature. There's a fascinating tshuva brought down in the Pischei Tshuva, in the Simonim and Hilchos Avelos by Kruram. It's a Pesach Shuva perhaps people have seen before, that the government had wanted to not bury a body right away, to wait a couple days until burial, of course violating the Torah's precept of Halanos HaMeis. And he actually quotes, in this Pesach Shuva, he quotes Rav Moshe Mendelssohn, that Rav Moshe Mendelssohn had a more positive perspective on allowing the lack of burial. And in the Shuva, he very much said, if this is something we're not allowed to do based on the government, that's what we have to follow. But the government's entire ideal, said the Chassam Sofer, was that perhaps a person had not died, a person was still alive, and therefore by burying a person right away, perhaps the person will be buried alive. Quite a thought. The Chassam Sofer said, for us to assume that the medical knowledge of this country, in Germany, in Hungary, in Austria, that they're going to teach us about time of death and when a person is really dead and what determines death. And we're going to use their knowledge and their science to affect our halacha. He said that's something that completely cannot be accepted. It's a complete rejection of allowing, essentially, the government to define halachic issues. There's a fascinating tshuva that Chassam Sofer discusses a little bit, but even more so in his Talmud, the Maharam Shik. The Maharam Shik was one of the most significant Talmud in the Chassam Sofer, and it was a question which I hope no Rav ever gets posed, and it's hard to imagine someone posing this nowadays. That the Chassam Sofer and the Maharam Shik and others, they held by the opinion of a mechitza that the mechitza had to be completely sort of like this mechitza, right? Not see-through. It couldn't be the way that Rav Moshe Feinstein said the top third can be see-through. So people came to the Maharam Shik in the mid-1850s and they said the following: either change the mechitza, make it slatted so that the women can see through, right? You can make slats, or we're going to leave shul and we're going to open our businesses on Shabbos. That was the type of question that was posed. I see that the Truman Rabbanim perhaps is no different now than the ultimatums. So 160 years ago that was posed. And the Maharam Shik, quoting his Rebbe, the Chassam Sofer, said, the feeling might be, on the surface level, that the motivation is that the women should see, and that motivation itself is something that obviously has value to it. But the underlying currents is that of a change of the shul, a change of the culture, a change of the mitzvah. The Maharam Shik said, you know what, you want to go be Mechal Shabbos? Maybe we'll lose a few people, but we're not going to change at all what we do in the Beis Knesset. The Chassam Sofer, and we'll conclude with this, and the Chassam Sofer was a person of incredible strength, and he believed that the only way to truly hold on to students is by essentially affecting, impacting, speaking to, connecting with every element of a student. It's not enough to give a shiur, but you have to be involved. The yeshiva has to affect every aspect of a Talmud's mind and behavior and midos. That's the only way that you form a student in such a way that they can withstand the pressures of the outside world. There's a famous story told by the Chassam Sofer that there was a brilliant young budding Talmid Chacham that came to interview for a spot in the yeshiva in Pressburg. And everything that happened, the Chassam Sofer was involved in every aspect. He was like a micromanager. If people know the very famous Jewish historian Jacob Katz, who's written a number of excellent books. So he said that the Chassam Sofer is almost like an oracle in the Frum community. Everything revolved around him. And the Talmid, after interviewing, walked outside and he left. And the Chassam Sofer refused to take him. He didn't take him into the yeshiva. So when they asked him later, why not? He said, because when he walked out, I saw him step on the schach. It was after Sukkot. The schach was lying on the ground. And Chassam Sofer saw him step on the schach on the way leaving the yeshiva in Pressburg. He says, someone with that type of lack of sensitivity cannot do in our yeshiva. Our yeshiva needs the complete fidelity, every aspect of their being, towards me, towards the yeshiva, towards Torah sensitivity. And in that sense, we'll conclude with this, the Chassam Sofer's impact is felt today, almost 200 years later, with equal strength. No compromise, no involvement in the secular community. And the Chassam Sofer, people read a book that came out about 7-8 years ago called Real Jews. Chassam Sofer is very much sort of the forerunner of Haredi Judaism in that lack of compromise. Second personality, and I know there are people here, of course, who live in Washington Heights or have been associated with the Boris community for many years, of course, is Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch is a person that even now, 202 years after his birth, still captures the fascination. Right? In many ways, Rav Hirsch was almost like a figure like Moshe Rabbeinu, as are all these personalities. Someone that rose to the occasion of their time, someone who stepped independently into a situation of complete conflict, even as a young person, and rose again to the needs of his community. Rav Hirsch's life is well known to many, so I'll just pinpoint a couple of the highlights that relate to this conversation. The first, as we said, was born in 1808. And again, perhaps not in the same degree as Chasam Sofer, clearly was a person of incredible gifts in many ways. His speaking, his writing, his thoughtfulness, his abilities as Talmid Chacham. 1828, he became the Talmid, or the key Talmid, of Rav Yaakov Etlinger, who was the famous author of the Aruch Haner. And then in 1830, he accepted a position to be the Rav of the community of Oldenburg. And Rav Hirsch recognized, for lack of a better term, the complete confusion that Jews found themselves. The sway of the Reform movement, the sway of Haskalah. A Jew had no sense of what it meant to be a Jew, had no sense of Tamei HaMitzvos. And during his years in Oldenburg and then afterwards, Rav Hirsch realized that he would need to write something, he would need to have an impact that was felt throughout Germany, throughout Moravia, Czechoslovakia. And he decided that, of course, that impact would be through the writing of the Chorev. The Chorev, which I imagine every person here owns and has read before, it's the best sefer for any thinking person as far as mitzvos. It's a great sefer for college-age students. But Rav Hirsch, and this tells us where the Jewish community was at, felt that if he would write the Chorev first, there would be no audience. I think where Germany was at in those days. He was a young person, 27, 28 years old. The entire community was rushing away from the ideals of orthodoxy. And he felt that if he would write Chorev, no one would buy it, no one would read it. Imagine that 170 years later. So anybody know, if you're asking, what he did first? 19 letters. So what he said was, instead, he's got to sort of have to make his bones, he had to make his name by writing 19 letters. And the 19 letters, as people know, was this imaginary dialogue between a young rabbinic student, Rav Naftali, and a young disenfranchised Jew, Binyamin. And it was a book of holding no punches. Right? The book began, sort of the 19 letters of Naftali's response to Benjamin, Binyamin, was Binyamin voicing the feeling of people of that generation. What's the point of being a Jew? Who needs it? All that it's brought us is suffering. All that it's brought us is degradation. And in the 19 letters, Rav Hirsch, in responding to Rav Naftali, he utilized essentially the powers of persuasion of that day. Not just pushing issues under the rug, but attacking, rigorously attacking any argument that a person could make for reform, for change, for leaving Yahadus. And it was so brilliant, and it was so clear that it created essentially like a revolution among many young Jews in Germany in the 1830s. And that then, in 1838, gave him the popularity and the fame to write Chorev. And once he wrote Chorev, and once he was known, first in 1841, he became the Rav in Hanover. 1846, he became the Rav in Moravia. For all of Moravia, he occupied the same position as the Maharal in Nikolsburg in Moravia. And he was an internationally known personality. He argued in front of parliament. His writings were known by everyone. He was still a very young person. He was passionate. He was eloquent. And perhaps the key moment of his life was an act of bravery that I'm sure I would never have the ability to do. And that was the following. The community, the most famous community in Germany, of course, was Frankfurt. You know, Frankfurt, the home of the Hafla, Rav Horowitz, and the Chasam Sofer. If people know Frankfurt in 1850, 1851, the Reform had made such inroads. They had done away with Shechita, they had done away with Bris Milah, they had tried to change when Shabbos was going to be. And the great community of Frankfurt, by 1851, had, anybody know how many members or how many participants? 11 participants in the community in Frankfurt. Right? Perhaps maybe 50 families total. 11 people who were actually involved in the running of the community. I mean, what would be equivalent to that? It's almost like the imagery of the Ramban coming in the early 13th century to Yerushalayim and not finding a minion. That would almost be the equivalent of Frankfurt in 1851. And the Jews in 1851 in Frankfurt, they petitioned the government, and they got permission from the government to form their own Jewish community, separate from the Reform community that existed at the time. And out of some crazy notion, they petitioned Rav Hirsch to come be the Rav of the community. Now this would be, Rav Hirsch leaving Moravia at the time to go to Frankfurt, would be dome to Rav Lau leaving, being the chief rabbi of Israel. And this is no offense to Rabbi Lau or any other chief rabbi of Israel, but a chief rabbi in Moravia or other areas meant total control. You weren't a figurehead, you weren't someone who spoke and no one listened. You controlled education in the schools and the yeshivas and mikvaos of hundreds of thousands of Jews. And Rabbi Lau leaving in the height of his powers, Eretz Yisrael, to become the Rav in Pelham Parkway. And I lived in Pelham Parkway, so that should be no offense. But a community whose perhaps best years were behind it, and now a shul struggling even to have a minyan. Rav Hirsch recognized that the only way that the impact of Torah Derech Eretz, which we'll discuss in a moment, could be felt, is by revitalizing the communities. It wasn't enough to be in Moravia, separate from essentially the heart of Reform, but only by revitalizing Frankfurt and Hamburg and Berlin could the true impact be felt. And therefore, he came back. And the Siyata Dishmaya that he experienced, first of all, he said that we have to build, as everyone knows, unfortunately, of course, the shuls were destroyed in 1938, the most beautiful building in Frankfurt. We have to have the most beautiful choir. The chazan has to be dressed in such a way. The rav has to be dressed in such a way. Education has to be on the highest level. Everything has to be on the highest level. His ability to bring back the Jews of Frankfurt, to build a community of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and that confidence and that pride extended well beyond Frankfurt. Again, to Hamburg and Berlin and other communities where there was such a feeling of yeyush, of giving up, because of the inroads and the complete dominance of the Reform community. There's much more that could be said about Rav Hirsch. Let me just end by one thought and reflection on perhaps his greatest achievement, other than the communal achievement, namely that of the doctrine of Torah Derech Eretz. I mean, to say you want to talk about Torah Derech Eretz is like, I don't know, it's like entering into stormy waters. You know, it's like anybody who goes to YU, so they know that, you know, to try to define in 30 seconds what Torah Mada is, it's a joke. Right? No one really knows what it is, no one knows. Right? So Torah Derech Eretz, really for Rav Hirsch, meant one of two very different things. We'll just spend a minute on this. I'm sure people have read widely on the topic. On the one hand, it was something that affected essentially day-to-day life, right? How a Western Jew, a German Jew, dresses, having an occupation, how they speak, a certain elegance, a certain civility, right? And unfortunately, this is again my own editorializing. I believe it's something that's very much in short order or not stressed enough nowadays, right? The ethics and civility and was a properness of speech that he very much brought about. And that was that change. Having a job, being a part of civilization. He discussed, I'm not sure if he knew the Maharal or not, the Maharal's idea of Torah Derech Eretz, which is certain hanhagat tivit, the certain sort of connection with the natural order. That's also a part of like the day-to-day Torah Derech Eretz. And then, of course, there was the philosophy of Torah Derech Eretz, which perhaps is more complicated, that somehow the relationship between secular learning and Torah. And Torah Derech Eretz, to some degree, has been, at least according to his grandchildren, and according to Rav Schwab, who, of course, is discussed these topics in his essays, the Torah Derech Eretz, in certain ways, has been hijacked, as often is the case. Right? People always hijack, you know, personalities or ideologies. I mean, even when Rav Hirsch himself came to Moravia in 1846, everyone wanted to say, he's our Rav. So the leftists looked at him and the way that he dressed, the way that he spoke, said, yeah, he stands for us. And the right-wing faction said, no, he's a true Torah personality, he stands for us. It's very much what's happened in the last 17 years since the Patir Rav Soloveitchik as well. And Torah Derech Eretz has been hijacked. It's been hijacked by those people that assume the Torah Derech Eretz is synonymous with Torah Madam, which probably is not true. And hijacked by those that also said that Torah Derech Eretz for Rav Hirsch was only a Hurrah Shah. It was only there for the time. If Rav Hirsch had his dream, there would be no secular studies and no science and no math. He only did this as a response to the Reform movement, and Rav Schwab clearly proves that that is not the case through the many writings of Rav Hirsch. Term Derech Eretz, and it's perhaps it's more complicated than saying synthesis, which Sharmada might be. Term Derech Eretz is the learning of secular studies, the acceptance of secular studies, but the recognition that Torah dominates every aspect of secular studies. There's no two different cultures that are somehow synthesized, but that Torah itself speaks to, dominates, controls, informs every aspect of secular studies, but the secular studies themselves should be learned, should be understood, should become a part of a person's life as well. You know, the hour is getting late, so let me conclude with the last two personalities. And then we'll wrap up. The third personality, and again a person of incredible depth, and a person whose legacy perhaps is also confused, is that of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter lived in a completely different milieu for most of his life than the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer was born in Germany and lived in Hungary and Austria, and Rav Hirsch was very much a product also of a German culture. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter lived for most of his life, and most of his impact was felt in Lithuania. And he was born outside of Kovno the year after Rav Hirsch was born in 1809. Again, so Rav Chassam Sofer was born in the 1770s, 1760s, Rav Hirsch in 1808, Rav Yisrael Salanter in 1809. And Rav Yisrael Salanter is marked for, besides being an incredible innovator, an incredible leader, and someone whose impact is felt perhaps in the same way as the Chassam Sofer's is today, as a person that was capable of tremendous change, a tremendous change of direction, in ways that perhaps many of us are often not able to accomplish in our own life. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and it sounds like a broken record, also was known as a genius at a young age. He was referred to, anybody know what he was referred to as a child even? The Alfasi Katan. He was like a miniature riff. He was so brilliant that even at the age of 8, 9, 10, the Rabbanim in the city outside Kovno where he lived referred to him as the Alfasi Katan. And at a young age, 12 years old, in the year 1820, 1821, his father recognized that he could not teach him himself, so he sent him off to Salant. Right? Every time you hear a name, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the person was not born with the name Salanter. Salanter is always, of course, the town that a person came from. And in Salant, he was supposed to learn by one of the Gedolim of the day, Reb Royd, but he became fascinated by the hidden tzaddik of Salant, Yosef Zundel. Rav Yosef Zundel of Salant. Now, Yosef Zundel perhaps is a personality that we don't see much of nowadays. A person that was a complete nister. He was hidden from the public eye. He was a water carrier, right? He didn't have a yeshiva. He didn't give a shir. You know, not to be harsh, but nowadays people enjoy, you know, if you're somebody, you don't want to be a water carrier. You want to have your name, you want to give a shir, you want to speak around the world, you want to, you know, you're not a water carrier just hanging out in the woods. And Rav Salanter, even as a kid, recognized, 13, 14 years old, that this Rav Yosef Zundel was somebody special. But he really knew that he wasn't seeing the full picture. He was a water carrier, he learned in the Beis Medrash. You know, he knew there was something there, so he dedicated himself, and this is a very famous story of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, to essentially, for lack of a better term, people have read Hillel Goldberg's book before on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, it's what he got his PhD in, so he used the term stalked, that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to stalk Rabbi Yosef Zundel, right? Not in an inappropriate way, but I'm sure it was done with only L'shem Shemayi motives. And Rabbi Yosef Zundel would walk into the woods, and he would meditate in the woods, he would think in the woods, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter would follow him into the woods and stand back behind a tree, and he would watch Rabbi Yosef Zundel in his bedidus, in his moments of aloneness with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. And I guess one day, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, as a kid, he, you know, fell over a twig or made some noise, and all of a sudden, Rabbi Yosef Zundel turns around, sees him there, and says something very simple, but something that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said changed his life. Namely, Rabbi Yisrael, learn Musar so that you can become a Yorei Shemayim, you can become a fearer of God. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, and his Talmidim said afterwards, that it was this message that just completely went straight through him. It touched him. It went straight through his outer core. touched him to his very essence, and he decided that he wouldn't just learn the pilpul of the time, the Gemara of the time, but that he would dedicate himself, along with his studies in Gemara, he would dedicate himself to introspection and to limud musar. And that was true for the next 18 years of his life, until he was 30 years old. And when he became around that age, 30, 31, he realized that he wanted to start having an impact. And even though he felt initially, you know, I'll be like my Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Zundel. I'll be a water carrier. I'll be a quote-unquote nobody. He realized that he had an ability to affect people and to impact the world. And he had already sensed, even in Lithuania, the changing winds of Haskalah, and he realized that there was a need to step into the fray. You know, very briefly, again, there's a lot on this topic, but he realized that the only way that he can have an impact on the community, as is probably true today as well in many circles, is by establishing himself as a lamdin, as a great thinker. So he would go to the cities throughout Lithuania. Again, it took a certain amount of confidence and gusto. And he would place a sheet of paper in the door of the Beis Medrash, and he would say there's going to be a sheer klali on whatever topic it is. They say a funny story that the young men of the towns he would go to, they would try to embarrass him, they would try to humiliate him. So they would take down the sheet of paper from the wall of the Beis Medrash, and they would put up like a different sheet of paper, a completely different sheer. And if Rav Lanter would get up in Vilna to deliver this year, they would give him the Maor Mekomos, and lo and behold, it was a completely different topic. So the way the story goes, and it shows sort of the Adam who studies and thinks, he took about 10 seconds, 20 seconds, and then gave a perfect shear on the new list of Maor Mekomos. So students asked him afterwards, Rebbe, you know, what was the reason for waiting? You know, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, whatever it was. He said, I had to make a cheshbon at that time. If I were to say that I cannot give the shiur because new marmakomos, I couldn't establish myself as the lamdin that can have an effect on the Jewish community. But if I were to give the shiur right away, without hesitating, I would come off as a person of ego and of gaiva. So I waited just for a few moments. What should I do? How should I respond? That's like the Adam HaMusar. That's a person who's thinking through every aspect of his life. And in Vilna, once he was asked to give the shiur there full-time, the impact he had was tremendous. You know, in Vilna, the only form of learning, the epicenter, was the Beis Medrash. There wasn't limud musar, there wasn't a study of personal characteristics, of introspection. You come, you sit down, you learn, you become a Talmid Chacham. And Rabbi Yisrael Zalanter, even in his 30s, at a young age, created a revolution. He opened up Batei Musar, which are right next to the Beis Medrash, that every person, after finishing a shiur or a seder, every day would go into the Batei Musar, and he viewed those Batei Musar as like a clinic. You know, you go to the doctor, and the doctor looks at every aspect of who you are, and you would place yourself under that same microscope. That was revolutionary. It was revolutionary that he would include children and women and ignoramuses all in this process of limud musar. And he stayed in Vilna until the year 1848, and two events made him leave Vilna in 1848. Again, he had been wildly successful in establishing this musar, the batei musar, the component of musar into learning. Now, the first aspect, and again, this could be an entire lecture in of itself, was that in 1848, anybody know what happened in 1848 in Europe? The cholera epidemic. And he was concerned that in Vilna, people would not eat, people were not taking care of themselves. The Rav Yisrael Zalanter, much like the Briskers, had tremendous respect for modern medicine. And he used to put up signs, even though he never got involved in Vilna, Psak Halacha, he would put up signs that a person should be Mechal Shabbos, that they have to eat or take care of themselves. And the way the story goes, again, it's quite a story, was that he got up in Vilna on Yom Kippur, and he said a bracha, and he ate in front of the entire community as a way of giving people permission, essentially, to eat if they needed to during that great epidemic. And he was wildly criticized for that. And at the same time, many of the maskilim who thought they had like a blood brother the Rizos Lanter, someone that was innovative and someone who was a Mechadshon and someone that was up to date and someone who was educated, they pushed him and encouraged him to become the head of the seminary run by the Maskilim in Vilna in 1848. And between the pressure of becoming the head of that seminary and between, again, the criticism over what he did in the cholera epidemic, he left Vilna and he went to Kovna. In Kovna, he formed, again, a base Musar. But instead of being focused on the entire community, instead of making it something that for the entire community, he focused on a handful of Talmidim. He said, give me 10 Talmidim, I'll teach them, and together, he didn't mean this out of ego, we will change the world, we'll transform the world. And there in Kovna, drawn to him, was the great Rav Yitzchak Blazer, Rav Naftali Amsterdam, Rav Simchel Zissel Ziv, Rav Yaakov Yosef. And for those 8 years, he worked on those Talmidim, developing a Mahalach in Musar. And eventually, at the end of his life, in 1857, for the last 25 years or so, he left Lithuania. He traveled throughout Western Europe, through Germany, through Paris, trying to be Makarev, trying to inspire, trying to bring many of the techniques of Eastern Europe, Lithuania, to Western Europe. And he came back to Kovna and he died at the end of his life in the 1880s. But Rishon Salanter's impact was so profound in the sense that he didn't try to modernize Judaism. He didn't try to change the shul. He didn't try to change clothing. He didn't try to introduce education. But what he was adamant on was to change a Jew himself. If a Jew didn't know himself, he didn't understand himself, he was not a Yerushalmayan, he wasn't introspective, he wasn't worked out. So when the seeds and when the change, when Haskalah, when reform comes knocking at his door, he finds himself unprotected. But a person who is truly worked out and understands himself, understands motivations for Shmiras HaMitzvos, is a developed, worked out individual, you don't have to change Judaism, but just changing the very essence of each and every Jew, so that allowed what he felt to impact and to fight against the trends of the Haskalah. You know, in closing, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, his impact obviously is felt to this day. His Talmidim I mentioned before, the Talmidim of Simchel Zissel Ziv was the Alter Meis Lobotka, and among others as well. Their Talmidim were Rav Huttner and Rav Shach and Rav Ruderman and Rav Kamenetsky and Rav Henoch and Rav David Leibowitz. I mean, the Musar movement became something that became completely integrated. The idea of a Jew not just learning, but having a deep felt understanding, psychological understanding of who they are and why they're a Jew. And of course, as I said, that's something that's felt now 130 years after the death of Rav Yisrael Salanter. You know, the last individual whose impact was felt was the last of these four as far as the timeline, and perhaps also the most radical. And that, is, of course, was Rav Israel Hildesheimer. Rav Hildesheimer was born in 1820 in Germany, and also known as a prodigy. Rav Hildesheimer was someone who excelled on the highest level, both in Gemara and in mathematics and in linguistics. And he opened a yeshiva in Eisenstadt in Hungary in 1850. And the yeshiva was revolutionary in the sense that, first of all, you could not get into the yeshiva unless you had a deep understanding and a deep education of secular studies. In the yeshiva in Eisenstadt, they were machbid on proper German. They used modern techniques of pedagogy. They studied biblical criticism. There was in-depth Tanakh, in-depth Jewish history. And eventually, Rav Hildesheimer left Hungary. He became the Rav in Berlin in the 1860s, and he opened there the famed Hildesheimer Academy that many people of diverse backgrounds went through. Rav Hildesheimer was unique in the sense that he was completely fearless. Right? He didn't get a salary, which is always a good idea of a Rav if one can do it, and was never concerned about criticism. And his entire life, he felt criticism. Criticism from the Reform movement, right? That because of Hildesheimer never gave in to the Reform movement, he never felt orthodoxy could be changed. criticism, of course, from the right wing also, that said, how can you be running yeshiva where there's biblical criticism and Jewish history and German and a whole new approach to Limud Gemara? But Hildesheimer felt fearless in his assessment that the only way to fight reform, which again was radical in Germany in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, was that a person was so well educated, a person was so entrenched in knowledge of secular studies, he was so elegant, he was so able to combine Torah with other areas as well, that he felt the confidence to fight off any challenge from outside of him. He was radical in other ways as well. He was radical that as much as he denounced the Reform movement, who's maybe one of the first of modern Rabbanim to join together with the Reform movement and the Conservative movement to fight off anti-Semitism, he joined with the Reform and the Conservative movement to support charities in Israel, to be involved in a whole host of other areas as well. And the Hildesheimer Academy was something that produced the Rabbanim that through the 1860s and 70s, 80s, 90s, until the close of the Academy in the 30s, that they produced Rabbanim that could very much speak to the needs of the German community. And I think back to my the early days of YU, or maybe even 20, 30 years ago, I'm sure many of you were here, and the idea that someone would be here in YU in the 1960s and 70s, going through the sort of sea changes that were existing in the United States, you know, and their Rebbe basically didn't speak English and could in no way relate to what the average American 9-year-old was going through in the year 1968. So obviously, if the impact was felt, it was felt more as far as seeing the personality, as far as that personality truly being involved in every aspect of a student's life. I say that in a general sense, I'm sure there are cases where that was not true. And so through Hildesheimer realized that the only way to affect the German youth was by training Rabbanim that could very much speak to the German youth. Obviously, when Hildesheimer was Nifter, David Zvi Hoffman took over as the chancellor of the seminary, and ultimately the last chancellor, anybody know who was a Sridi Eish, right? Rav Weinberg. There's a very sad footnote. There's a must-read book written by Mark Shapiro, Dr. Mark Shapiro, about the life of Rabbi Weinberg. You may not agree with everything that he has in there, but certainly as far as discussing that time of history and Rabbi Weinberg and the effects of Rabbi Weinberg's life. So people see that in his book, at the end, there's actually a letter that the Sridi Eish wrote to Hitler, right? Trying to figure out what was Hitler's motivations, right? What exactly do you want to do? If in fact you want to eliminate the Jewish community, then tell us now. Tell us now, we'll leave. It'll be something which would be an embarrassment to you if you go ahead and have blood on your hands. And that was essentially the last chapter of the Hildesheimer Academy. Obviously, these are issues that today, the legacy of the Chassam Sofer is essentially almost like the first Haredi Jew in response to modernization. The legacy of Rav Hirsch, who strove to understand secular knowledge, but have Torah be dominant over it. Rav Yisrael Salanter, who set up an entire system of Musar and self-understanding and working on oneself. Rav Hildesheimer, who probably could correctly be viewed as almost a predecessor to YU and a certain synthesis of Torah Mada. Now, these are issues that today we still grapple with. Essentially, every moment of our life, every day of our lives, right? How much, how little of the world enter into our own Dalet Amos, how much do we escape, how much do we integrate? Now, I was reflecting in closing that I, like most people, and I'm sure many people here, saw that Maccabees video, right? You know, that my kids must have watched, 90, 100 times. And it was a Hanukkah video, I'm sure many people saw it. It was a sensation in the sense that they're now up to almost 4 million hits on YouTube, right? If you look at a YU Torah shir, a top shir is what? 500 hits. But this, 1,000 hits. Rob, it's no offense to you. You're doing, 4 million people. And obviously people know that by and large, so this was something that was tremendous for the Jewish community. The amount of people that emailed the participants of this video, there's the first time they ever lit Hanukkah candles, the first time they felt pride to be a Jew, when they see young Jewish Orthodox men who look normal, who act normal, the impact on Hanukkah observance, maybe beyond, was tremendous. But at the same time, something like that, not in a critical light, raises the exact same issues that affect daily life. To take Jewish themes, garb them in secular music and in up-to-date music, garb them in images or or overall, I guess again, a garb that is clearly secular. Again, that's not a criticism, but that very much speaks that almost in every area of our life, we grapple with those issues in dress and behavior and education and ideology and community. So the storm winds that were raised in the mid-18th century, late 18th century, are things that found resolution, but very much still stir within us as we seek to make our own ways of resolving the conflict and to live a life of Torah, understanding, of course, the milieu that we live in. Thank you very much.
Do you think that the Haredim never gave up trying to destroy the seminary, and that's why they ended up dying in Germany?
No. Right. Could be. It could be. I'm not sure. I'm sure some people know, but yeah.
Oh.
Right, right. Well, I said before, I'm not sure, just that much of Haskalah was a reaction to the complete emotionalism of Hasidus. I mean, so that very much led to the counter-response of Haskalah, and that's part of what gave Haskalah such a, you know, its legs in becoming, in its popularity. What's that?
Hasidism actually of Haskalah?
That's my understanding. Right. I mean...
Please, yeah.